Hello and welcome to British Eugenics. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. My co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring, and today's episode is called Sir Francis Galton's Speech. Well, shall we talk a little bit about eugenics, Max? Shall we move into our eugenics presentation, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, and we've got a speech by Sir Francis Galton to talk about today, way back in 1904. It was read before the Sociological Society at a meeting in the School of Economies, which is in London University, and Professor Carl Pearson was in the chair. And I particularly like the speech because he uses an analogy which I have used before about nationalism. So I particularly like this, and he also makes some other points as well. So remember, this is Sir Francis Galton. This is the chap that coined the word eugenics. He says, "Eugenics is the science which deals with all influences that improve the inborn qualities of a race, also with those that develop them to the utmost advantage. The improvement of the inborn qualities or stock of some one human population will alone be discussed here." I'll just stop there, because when he talks about race there, he's talking about it as the way that we would use nation today. And he's not talking about a multicultural country and working on that. He's talking about a specific ethnic group and working on that to improve the inborn qualities. And he says, "What is meant by improvement? What by the syllable EU in eugenics, whose English equivalent is good? There is considerable difference between goodness in the several qualities and in that of the character as a whole. The character depends largely on the proportion between qualities, whose balance may be much influenced by education. We must therefore leave morals as far as possible out of the discussion, not entangling ourselves with the almost hopeless difficulties they raise as to whether a character as a whole is good or bad. Moreover, the goodness or badness of character is not absolute, but relative to the current form of civilization. A fable will best explain what is meant. Let the scene be the zoological gardens in the quiet hours of the night, and suppose that, as in old fables, the animals are able to converse, and that some very wise creature who had easy access to all the cages, say a philosophic sparrow or rat, was engaged in collecting the opinions of all sorts of animals with a view of elaborating a system of absolute morality. It is needless to enlarge on the contrariety of ideals between the beasts that prey and those they prey upon, between those of the animals that have to work hard for their food and the sedentary parasites that cling to their bodies and suck their blood, and so forth. A large number of suffrages in favour of maternal affection would be obtained, but most species of fish would repudiate it, while among the voices of birds would be heard the musical protest of the cuckoo. Though no agreement could be reached as to absolute morality, the essentials of eugenics may be easily defined. All creatures would agree that it was better to be healthy than sick, vigorous than weak, well-fitted than ill-fitted for their part in life. In short, that it was better to be good rather than bad specimens of their kind, whatever that kind might be. So with men. There are a vast number of conflicting ideals, of alternative characters, of incompatible civilizations, but they are wanted to give fullness and interest to life. Society would be very dull if every man resembled the highly estimable Marcus Aurelius or Adam Bede. The aim of eugenics is to represent each class or sect by its best specimens. That done, to leave them to work out their common civilization in their own way." And I really like this, because what he's saying here is that there are different species of animal, and each one of them would rather do something in a different way that might actually be negative to these other animals. But the one thing that they would all agree on is being the best example of your kind. And I think we can apply this to nationalism. I mean, you can say that the best Jew is somebody that advocates for Jews, does everything for Jews, does the best for Jews, whatever it is, and puts the group of the Jews at the center of everything. That is going to be the best Jew, the most Jewiest Jew is going to be the best Jew. And you can say the same thing about white people. The most Aryan of white people is going to be the best example there is of a white man. And as a nationalist, you want to be the best representative that you can be of your people group. So effectively, when you see that there's somebody who is Jewish, and instead of doing what's best for Jews, they are actually talking about all the bad things that Jews have done and they're condemning them, then they're not actually being a very good person. They're actually being treasonous, treacherous to their own people. So what we should really want, rather than raising up these people that run down their own ethnic group, we should be saying, well, you know, that's not very good. And it's the same with black people. You get blacks that will actually run down their own group. And that's not good. They should be raising their group up. And that's the way that we should be. And that's the way we should be as nationalists, I think, is praising other people when they stand up for their group and put their group's interests ahead of their own individual interests. And I've likened this before with animals in a similar way to this. I've said that, if you're an antelope, it might not be very nice to have the crocodiles eating you because there's a pool of crocodiles there. Well, the answer to that is to keep the antelopes and the crocodiles separate, isn't it? And then the crocodiles can't eat the antelopes. But if you mix them all together, that's what is going to happen, because it is natural, comes naturally to a crocodile to behave like a crocodile. And it comes naturally, if you're a representative of a people group, to behave like that people group. The problem comes when you mix all the people groups together in one area. And then you get all these negative things that happen. If you just kept the people groups separate, each in their right place, then everything would be fine. And you would want there to be the very best example of each one of these people groups, which is what eugenics was trying to achieve through breeding, to produce the very best example. And as he says here, he's talking about a specific race. So he's not talking about breeding out all the black people within Britain, because at this time you just had white people in Britain. So he's talking about the British as a race, and the same methods that would improve the qualities of the British race, exactly the same methods would also improve the qualities of the black African race or the Chinese race. The same methods would improve these qualities. And that is the one thing that all different groups and all different animals would agree on, that the very best thing to do, the what is good, is to be the very best example of whatever you are. Because you can't bring this morality into it. I mean, you can't say, well, it's immoral for a crocodile because he eats the antelope. I mean, he's supposed to eat the antelope. That's what he does. He's a crocodile. And you want him to be the very best example of a crocodile there is. You also want the antelopes to be the very best example of an antelope there is. And everything works together when everything is in its correct place. And I think the problem that we have today is that everything is out of place. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I entirely agree with you, actually. It's also, I find it interesting that Francis Galton uses analogy in order to make what is a very simple argument, but a simple argument that explains complicated issues, really, or issues that other people find complicated. And it reminded me, really, of previous occasions when we spoke about Robert Blatchford, who wrote Britain for the British and Merry England. Robert Blatchford, who used the same kind of analogy or parable within his writings, where he was addressing a fictitious Mr. Smith in a very similar way, explaining what other people find complicated issues by using a simple analogy, effectively.
Yeah, it is a good analogy that he uses there. I'm very impressed with his speech, actually. Continuing with it, a considerable list of qualities can easily be compiled that nearly everyone except cranks would take into account when picking out the best specimens of his class. It would include health, energy, ability, manliness, and courteous disposition. Recollect that the natural differences between dogs are highly marked in all these respects, and that men are quite as variable by nature as other animals of like species. Special aptitudes would be assessed highly by those who possess them, as the artistic faculties by artists, fearlessness of inquiry and veracity by scientists, religious absorption by mystics, and so on. There would be self-sacrificers, self-tormentors, and other exceptional idealists, but the representatives of these would be better members of a community than the body of their electors. They would have more of those qualities that are needed in a state, more vigour, more ability, and more consistency of purpose. The community might be trusted to refuse representatives of criminals and of others whom it rates as undesirable. And I mean, he says you'd have to be a crank here to not want this. And yet that's what we have as a civilization today. We think that it's wrong, this idea of bringing out the best in people through their biology. We just concentrate on trying to bring the best out on people with education. And yet 90% or 80 to 90% of who we are is defined by our genetics. It's only about 10% that is malleable. I mean, we've talked about this before in the series, but I mean, you can increase people's abilities only so much by education. And as they get older, they revert back to being the type that they are. I mean, you cannot fill a pint glass with more than a pint of liquid. So the best way to do things like this is to ensure that people have the best abilities to begin with, rather than having people that are born with biological problems, prone to disease, prone to mental problems. I mean, these people, they do the best that they can, but surely it would have been much better for them if they'd been born into a body with a healthy mind and a healthy body. And it is interesting, I find, that, you know, he says that you'd have to be a crank not to want this. And yet fast forward 120 years and we have an entire society of cranks where only about, 5% of society would look at eugenics and say that it's probably a negative thing. I mean, it may be less than that because there is so much social pressure in order to denounce this. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of social pressure. And anybody who advocates eugenics in any way is immediately attacked. And it's an ad hominem attack that they're attacked with, and they're accused of wanting the same things that the Nazis wanted. Even though eugenics predates the Nazis, you get attacked for wanting the same things that the Nazis wanted. And it's an attack upon you that's intended to shut you up rather than to prove that what you're saying is incorrect. Because anybody who has got any logical ability whatsoever looking at the situation would say, yes, it would be good if we could, through eugenic principles, eliminate lots of needless diseases amongst our population. And if we could improve the abilities and the qualities of our population, you know, no sane person, as you say, no sane person would say that would be a wrong thing. But you know, here we are in the early part of the 21st century in a situation where that is just the case, and this is one of the absurdities. It is a problem because those people who are opposed to eugenics, who have malicious intent, they play upon the sort of innocent sensibilities of people, and they turn around and say, "Oh no, you know, if you've got any kind of minor deformity, no matter how minor it is, you know, you're under a eugenic regime, you'll be carted off and castrated, and not be able to marry and have children," you know, which isn't the case. And you know, we've in previous episodes of our discussions, we've spoken about the fact that where perhaps eugenicists have gone wrong in the past is that they have practiced more, that they have spoken too much about negative eugenics of preventing people with undesirable characteristics from reproducing than positive eugenics, which is the encouragement of people with attractive and valuable features to encourage them to have more children, and so therefore change the proportions within society through a positive process. And I think I've said what I need to on that.
that seems to be what he's talking about here is positive eugenics. He says, let us for a moment suppose that the practice of eugenics should hereafter raise the average quality of our nation to that of its better moiety at the present day, and consider the gain. The general tone of domestic, social and political life would be higher. The race as a whole would be less foolish, less frivolous, less excitable, and politically more provident than now. Its demagogues, who played to the gallery, would play to a more sensible gallery than at present. We should be better fitted to fulfil our vast imperial opportunities. Lastly, men of an order of ability, which is now very rare, would become more frequent, because the level out of which they arose would itself have arisen. And this is a problem that we have today. Professor Edward Dutton has written about this, about the lack of geniuses that we have. We have less and less geniuses that are being born each year as the average IQ gets lower and lower. And that is the effect of the dysgenic society that we live in today. We literally promote dysgenics instead of eugenics. And he really does lay it out clearly here. The level out of which they would arise from would itself have arisen. And that is the importance about this. And he comes up with some ways to do this. He says the aim of eugenics is to bring as many influences as can reasonably be employed to cause the useful classes in the community to contribute more than their proportion to the next generation. The course of procedure that lies within the functions of a learned and active society, such as the sociological may become, would be somewhat as follows. Number one, dissemination of a knowledge of the laws of heredity, so far as they are surely known, and promotion of their further study. Few seem to be aware of how greatly the knowledge of what may be termed the actuarial side of heredity has advanced in recent years. The average closeness of kinship in each degree now admits of exact definition and of being treated mathematically, like birth and death rates and the other topics with which actuaries are concerned. And this is something that is now just being hidden, isn't it? I mean, one of these statistics here would be the average IQ, and looking at the average IQ and how can we raise this? And we won't do that. And talking here about the knowledge of the laws of heredity, most people think everybody is born as a blank slate. Everybody has the ability to become a genius. And that's not true. You know, we have heredity. I mean, it's common sense, really. You're like your parents because you inherit what you are like from your parents. If you're a musician, you inherit that from your parents. If you're the type that's going to be a doctor, your parents will probably have been very intelligent, like doctors as well. So we understand this. And all the research was done back then at the turn of the last century. But it gets all ignored today, and they say that it's all just racist science, I think that they call it. So he was saying that the general public need to be educated in this, and instead of that, we now have the sources that actually have this information, that collect all of these statistics in America. I was reading about this the other day, and they won't actually give this information out to people anymore. If there is any chance that the study that they're doing may show that there is a difference between people groups, and they literally will not give this information out, even though it's supposed to be publicly available, it's supposed to be available for all academics to do their research, and they won't allow them to do it. Academics have been turned away because the research that they're doing might show that there is a difference between people groups, which is the complete opposite of what Sir Francis Galton is advocating for here. He's saying this information needs to be not just aware for the academics, but for the general public. And today, it's not even there for the academics, let alone for the public. Any thoughts?
Well, I totally agree again. I think I've said in previous podcasts that we've done that there needs to be a pastoral service where the pastors concerned, where their responsibility is to improve the quality and the condition of the flock that they look after, and for them to be the perhaps the cement that prevents people from to use a phrase that I don't particularly like, but anyway, to prevent people from falling down the cracks between various elements of social care that are provided at the moment. You know, there is a fair bit of social care being provided at the moment and has been for many decades, but there are still people who suffer as a result of there not being a unified and comprehensive system of pastoralism to improve not only their condition but the condition of their children and the condition of the community in which they live, and now we've got a situation where people who previously will have fulfilled that role to some extent, religious priests and clergymen, etc., that they're now so woke and so left-wing and so biased against anything that's natural and healthy that it wouldn't even occur to them to try and provide the kind of pastoral care that would incorporate an element of eugenics, which would help communities to improve their condition, etc. And that's a very sad state of affairs.
Well, we're encouraged to think of ourselves as individuals. We're not encouraged to do what we can to improve the lives of the next generation. We're supposed to take everything that that we can. You know, it's the complete opposite of the way that things should be. So what he's saying here is you start with education. Number two, historical inquiry into the rates with which the various classes of society, classified according to their civic usefulness, have contributed to the population at various times in ancient and modern nations. There is strong reason for believing that national rise and national decline is closely connected with this influence. It seems to be the tendency of high civilization to check fertility in the upper classes through numerous causes, some of which are well known, others are inferred, and others again are wholly obscure. The latter class are apparently analogous to those which bar the fertility of most species of wild animals in zoological gardens. Out of the hundreds and thousands of species that have been tamed, very few indeed are fertile when their liberty is restricted and their struggles for livelihood are abolished. Those which are so and are otherwise useful to man becoming domesticated. There is perhaps some connection between this obscure action and the disappearance of most savage races when brought into contact with high civilization, though there are other and well-known concomitant causes. But while most barbarous races disappear, some, like the Negro, do not. It may therefore be expected that types of our race will be found to exist which can be highly civilized without losing fertility. Nay, they may become more fertile under artificial conditions, as is the case with many domestic animals. So that's pretty interesting, because that is something that we've observed, isn't it? The more intelligent people are now having less children, and the less intelligent people are having more children. So that is something that has actually been reversed. And we do know that civilizations rise and fall, and we do know that part of that is, I mean, that there's a cycle, isn't there? Strong men create good times create lazy men and weak men, and the weak men create bad times, and it goes around in a cycle, doesn't it? So what he was talking about here is encouraging there to be more of the strong men that are born. Thoughts on this?
Another aspect of what he was saying there, it just struck me, applies to the fertility issues that are experienced with regard to giant pandas. You know, he mentions in the speech that animals that are kept in captivity and are provided with everything they need very often suffer a loss of fertility. And this is exactly what the problem with giant pandas. Giant pandas are under threat in the wild, and so therefore their numbers in the wild are decreasing. But those giant pandas that are raised in zoos have for decades now suffered very low fertility rates. There have been all sorts of problems to such an extent that giant pandas get sort of regularly transported all around the world to try and match up pairs of giant pandas in the hope that they will, the sort of sexual magic will be there between them and that they will produce children. And yet in many cases they don't.
So the more we provide for ourselves, the weaker we become, and the less people we actually produce as well. I think they did a study where they provided everything to these mice, and they ended up all turning degenerate. They ended up even becoming suicidal, some of them, and homosexuality was rife. It was a study that was just done with mice, and they literally provided everything that they needed, so they didn't have to do anything. And that was eventually what happened to them, which is similar to what's happening to us today with everything provided for us and not enough struggle. Number three, systematic collection of facts showing the circumstances under which large and thriving families have most frequently originated. In other words, the conditions of eugenics. The definition of a thriving family that will pass muster for the moment at least is one in which the children have gained distinctly superior positions to those who were their classmates in early life. Families may be considered large that contain not less than three adult male children. It would be no great burden to a society, including many members who had eugenics at heart, to initiate and to preserve a large collection of such records for the use of statistical students. The committee charged with the task would have to consider very carefully the form of their circular and the persons entrusted to distribute it. They should ask only for as much useful information as could be easily and would be readily supplied by any member of the family appealed to. The point to be ascertained is the status of the two parents at the time of their marriage, whence its more or less eugenic character might have been predicted, if the larger knowledge that we now hope to obtain had then existed. Some account would be wanted of their race, profession and residence, also of their own respective parentages and of their brothers and sisters. Finally, the reasons would be required why the children deserved to be entitled a thriving family. This manuscript collection might hereafter develop into a golden book of thriving families. The Chinese, whose customs have often much sound sense, make their honours retrospective. We might learn from them to show that respect to the parents of noteworthy children, which the contributors of such valuable assets to the national wealth richly deserve. The act of systematically collecting records of thriving families would have the further advantage of familiarizing the public with the fact that eugenics had at length become a subject of serious scientific study by an energetic society. And of course, today, all that sort of research is forbidden research, isn't it? Because it might upset the people that come from single mothers. You know, you can't have any research that shows that it's better to actually come from a family that stays together with a father and a mother than the chances that are there for somebody that's just brought up by their mother or just brought up by their father. And now we have two homosexuals that can adopt. And that's supposed to be just the same and give everybody just as good a chance because all the child needs is somebody that loves them. You know, anything that shows that actually what is needed is a traditional family in order to give the best chances to a child, you know, they just wouldn't do that anymore. And yet that's what he's saying here. That's what we should be investigating. We should be investigating what is it that raises people up to the best positions and look into that and look into the heredity. Interesting, the Chinese, they give people credits once they've actually dead. So they... You know, so they're partially doing that already. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, it's a situation where, as you say, instead of looking at the factors that make a family a thriving family, what today's social scientists are concentrating on excessively is ensuring that everybody has an equal opportunity, and not just an equal opportunity. Well, the test of whether they've had an equal opportunity is whether their life produces an equal outcome, which of course it never does. And so it then provides an endless, it provides endless ammunition for these sort of social scientists to say, oh yeah, well, we haven't yet achieved the situation of nirvana that would have to exist for every family to have an equal outcome. And the point is, if you try and force equal outcomes, you cause damage and you actually end up reducing standards instead of raising standards. So it becomes a sort of self-defeating exercise.
That's a good point there. They're striving for equality instead of striving for what makes people the best they can be. Number four, influences affecting marriage. The remarks of Lord Bacon in his essay on death may appropriately be quoted here. He says, with the view of minimizing its terrors, there is no passion in the mind of men so weak, but it mates and masters the fear of death. Revenge triumphs over death, love slights it, honour aspireth to it, grief flieth to it, fear preoccupateth it. Exactly the same kind of considerations apply to marriage. The passion of love seems so overpowering that it may be thought folly to try to direct its course, but plain facts do not confirm this view. Social influences of all kinds have immense power in the end, and they are various. If unsuitable marriages from the eugenic point of view were banned socially, or even regarded with the unreasonable disfavour which some attach to cousin marriages, very few would be made. The multitude of marriage restrictions that have proved prohibitive among uncivilized people would require a volume to describe. So a good point there as well. The social pressure on people, all they would need is social pressure to encourage people to marry wisely, and then they wouldn't marry unwisely because, you know, they would be mocked for doing so. I mean, we used to have a lot of social pressure upon women, prevented them from becoming single mothers, which was obviously good from the point of view as the child. And it was all social pressure and shaming. We should never underestimate the power of social shaming to encourage these things. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, there has been a lot of literature that's been produced where themes of love affairs have predominated, and where it's been established that people should marry for love, romantic love, rather than marry for other reasons, other perhaps more permanent and more fruitful reasons. What most people refer to as romantic love is what could logically be described as infatuation. Most people, if they meet somebody and they say, oh, we fell in love, it was love at first sight. Well, love at first sight is a kind of strange infatuation. If you and it's the sort of infatuation that you might have if you just happen to see a particular motor car or something of that sort that you thought was fabulous. You might see it and think, oh, what a fabulous car, I must have one of those, and then become infatuated in buying that car. It's the same kind of infatuation that makes you see a person of the opposite sex and think to yourself, oh, that person's wonderful. I must forge a lifelong relationship with them. The fact of the matter is, though, that the factors that tend to cause infatuations tend to be transitory and don't tend to last. And so the sort of initial infatuation that a young couple may have for themselves quite often struggles to survive against adversity. And if all they have is the infatuation and there is nothing else that makes them a suitable couple, that infatuation will eventually die on the rocks of adversity, and their marriage will die with it, and they'll end up being divorced. Whereas if the couple were suitable from every perspective, and they met each other and had their momentary infatuation, when their marriage then hit hard times, because they were suitable people and they would have qualities that complemented each other, they would be able to cleave together and overcome the problems that affect them, and their marriage would survive, and they would have a long and happy marriage instead of a short and and bitter one.
Yeah, you know, arranged marriages in countries that have arranged marriages like India, they have a remarkable success. But then there's all this social pressure on them to stay married. And then you have people that rather than this infatuation, they're just told this is who you are going to be marrying. And then they grow to be in love. And I think something like 99% of them succeed. And when they talk to them when they're in their 40s and their 50s, you know, the happiest they've, you know, the happiest 40 and 50 year olds you'll actually see from what I've seen of arranged marriages in India. So that would sort of imply that we did have a system like this before. Where there was social shaming, where you married within your caste, which was effectively a eugenic thing. You know, you had the most intelligent caste with the Brahmins, so they would marry Brahmins, and you had a warrior caste, you had a farmer caste, and then you had a lower caste. And you could say that that was really a eugenic society with each different group. And there are still traces of that left now in India. Number five, persistence in setting forth the national importance of eugenics. There are three stages to be passed through. Number one, it must be made familiar as an academic question until its exact importance has been understood and accepted as a fact. Number two, it must be recognized as a subject whose practical development deserves serious consideration. Number three, it must be introduced into the national conscience like a new religion. It has indeed strong claims to become an orthodox religious tenet of the future, for eugenics cooperate with the workings of nature by securing that humanity shall be represented by the fittest races. What nature does blindly, slowly, and ruthlessly, man may do providently, quickly, and kindly. As it lies within his power, so it becomes his duty to work in that direction. The improvement of our stock seems to me one of the highest objects that we can reasonably attempt. We are ignorant of the ultimate destinies of humanity, but feel perfectly sure that it is as noble a work to raise its level, in the sense already explained, as it would be disgraceful to abase it. I see no impossibility in eugenics becoming a religious dogma among mankind, but its details must first be worked out sedulously in the study. Overzeal leading to hasty action would do harm by holding out expectations of a near golden age, which will certainly be falsified and cause the science to be discredited. The first and main point is to secure the general intellectual acceptance of eugenics as a hopeful and most important study. Then let its principles work into the heart of the nation, which will gradually give practical effect to them in ways that we may not wholly foresee. So he was basically saying that overzeal and promising that things would improve very quickly, that would cause people to lose faith in eugenics. He had no idea that what would happen is we would have the Second World War, and the people that we went to war with would be associated with this eugenics. And from there, eugenics would then get this bad name, because Britain was involved in it, America was involved in it. And they just sort of highlighted the fact that the Germans were involved in it as well. And then it became associated with National Socialism, and it's been smeared ever since. And I really don't think that at this time when they were talking about this, they had any idea that that would happen. Any thoughts on this, Max?
No, I agree with you. I don't think that they had any idea that this would happen. It is very sad, really, that that things have turned out the way they have, especially in view of the fact that, you know, we've spoken on a number of occasions, and even earlier on in this particular podcast, we've spoken about what we've described as negative eugenics and positive eugenics. Some of the worst examples of negative eugenics were carried out in the United States of America. And you know, not in Germany at all, and you know, weren't actually advocated by the Germans. And so it's just that instead of post-war governments accepting the fact that both sides had advocated eugenics to various degrees, and that what we need to do is to look at eugenics and to extract the positive elements and use those and take those forward, what's happened is that the baby's been thrown out with the bathwater.
That's interesting that he brings up this religious aspect of it as well. I mean, that's something that you've highlighted, Max, that what you need is it like a pastoral sense in the same sense that you have a vicar that looks after his flock. They should also be looking after the genetic integrity of the nation as a whole. And I think Sir Francis Galton is sort of implying that sort of thing here by saying it should become a part of the national conscience. It should be like a new religion. Yes. Because it's working with nature instead of working against nature, and it's trying to improve things for the next generation. It's rather selfless, in fact, isn't it?
I was going to say Raymond Cattell, who was one of the founders of the Mensa Society, and a man who developed intelligence testing techniques, etc. He made exactly the same point. He was one of the founder members of the Eugenics Society, and he he produced a religion that he called Beyondism, which I think was suffered only from the fact that his ability to write inspirationally wasn't as good as his ability to write analytically. And so Beyondism hasn't really taken off, and perhaps didn't take off for the very same reasons that we've just discussed, that it employed eugenic principles, and so therefore may well have been just poo-pooed by post-war scientists. But he did advocate this religion, Beyondism, and there are other religions which apply the same sort of techniques as well.
I think at its heart, it's selflessness rather than selfishness. But as you say, today you're just encouraged to be an individual and not to identify with the nation and not to think about the later generations. Just think about yourself. Very, very selfish way of doing things that results in dysgenics. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more on British eugenics at radioalbion.com in the future.